Well, I want to thank again everybody for coming. I want to thank Rabbi Gottlieb for always saying yes when I ask, especially this week when I asked him only less than a week ago due to my own scheduling mishap. So this week Rabbi Gottlieb once again is speaking. He is a senior director of the Tikva Foundation, and in addition, a good friend, and it's always very interesting. Next 2 weeks, Rabbi Maccabee Avishur is next week. He used to be one of the heads of YU School Partnership. Now he's part of a Center for Jewish Day School. It's called Prisma. He'll be next week, and the week after is Rabbi Adler. Maccabee Avishur. Okay, without further ado, Rabbi Gottlieb.
Thank you so much, Howie. Good evening, everyone.
Oh, I'm sorry. One more mistake. Today, Rayla Feldman has yahrzeit for her husband. I'm sorry. And this shir is being... This is in his memory. He was one of the founders of Romer, and also happens to be one of my mentors, as he was a pediatric allergist where I did my fellowship at Columbia. And without further ado, Rabbi Gottlieb.
The learning should be the Ilui Nishmas, Dr. Feldman. Thank you again, Howie. Good evening, good to see everyone. One of the most beloved books in popular Jewish thought over the past half century is The Sabbath by Abraham Joshua Heschel. He offers a very, by now, famous, hopefully not cliched, but rightfully famous argument that Judaism, in contrast to Greece and other expressions of the Western sensibility, or their Western mind, was very conscious of time and time awareness, time consciousness, what the Rav and what halachic literature would call kedushas hazman, the sanctity of time. And that, relatively speaking, Judaism gave short shrift to the other modality of holiness or sanctity, namely sanctity of place, kedushas hamakom. Now, one could dispute the kind of priority that Heschel gives to time over space, and I think a search of the relevant sources in halacha, shas, and poskim, and just the Jewish worldview, the rabbinic worldview, would probably challenge that kind of prioritization somewhat, because we take kedushas hamakom quite seriously as well. The Mishnah in Kalim, which the Rambam quotes la halacha in Hilchos Beis HaBechira, that there were 10 portions of holiness given to the world, and most of them reside in Jerusalem and Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael. But the very idea of place is central to Jewish thinking, central to halacha, and however homiletically sermonically valuable Heschel's argument is, it doesn't necessarily stand up to the sharpest scrutiny. But tonight, I actually want to make a claim not about sanctity of space. I want to focus on space, a particular form of space or place, but not sanctified space, but profane space. And what do I mean by that? I want to argue that Tanakh specifically, and Jewish thought more generally, has some very interesting things to say about the notion of the city, the form of the city. And you know, this has been a very political season. Everybody feels it, for better or for worse. And I actually want to suggest that Yahadus has a, if one could actually call it this, a political theology of the city. In other words, it has a view of the function and the purpose of the city that is different than, let's say, the empire. Or that's different, on the other hand, talking about a smaller unit, that's different than the village or the tent or the homestead. In other words, when you think about the city in Jewish thought, starting with Tanakh, there are certain associations that the Torah want us to make with the city, for better or for worse, as we're going to see tonight. And that we, when we think about the city, we can also begin to extract lessons teachings about how we, as modern Jews living in the 21st century, many, many centuries, a few millennia after the Tanakh's views on the city, yet there is a kind of continuity in some respects to what the Torah has to say about the city. And I thought we would start not with a Torah source, but with a source in modern political thought, in modern political philosophy, that actually captures very powerfully and very succinctly for me some of the paradoxes or some of the tensions around the very idea of the city. And from that source, we're then going to look at Tanakh, and our destination tonight is the theme of Yosef in Mitzrayim, ethics and piety in the metropolis. Because many want to argue, many contemporary thinkers, people that I respect and I would argue we all should have respect for, make a kind of association, if you will, between Mitzrayim and modern-day empires, modern-day metropolises, modern-day cosmopolitan culture. And I think by looking at some of the sources in Tanakh about the city, the origins of the city, we can trace some of these themes and we can see whether we, in fact, have to be wary and have to take seriously the contention that America, on some philosophical or theological level, bears some resemblance to a modern-day Mitzrayim. So that's the big picture, that's the big claim, and we're going to now try to bear that out by looking at some interesting sources together. Let's look at this first source on page one. It's from a book that was recently published by Harvard University Press called Metamorphosis of the City by a French political philosopher, French political thinker by the name of Pierre Manet. He was a student of the writings of Leo Strauss and an actual student of the French Jewish thinker, classical liberal Raymond Aron, who was a significant critic of communism and Marxism in the middle of the 20th century. To the question, what is a city? What is the city? And for city, the word city is a stand-in, as you know, if you remember your ancient Greek philosophy. City is a kind of sign or stand-in for political society writ large. City, the Greeks had their ancient city-states, Athens, Thebes, Sparta. And as we become more massive and the scale of our civilization expands, we think about nations and empires. But any time that you hear the word city in a political tract or a political treatise, you should think it's not just a city, it's not like New York City, it's political civilization or civilization society. And so Manet asks the question, what is a city? It is tempting to reply equally or indifferently that it is a big family or a little world. That a city is like a microcosm of the world. It's a little world, literally microcosm, a little world. Or it's like a big family. Oh, you know, we're living in the city. You know, we're cousins, but even if we're not cousins, we feel like we're related. We're one big happy family. That's what a city in its ideal sense is. These are illusions that are inseparable from the city. This is just an illusion, Manet tells us. A city is not a little world or a big family. In reality, the city cruelly or imperiously subordinates the family and the world. In truth, the city, in a very cruel and sort of precipitous way, assumes a pride of place over the family and over the world. It takes young men from their families living and brings them back dead. Well, that's what cities and nations do. If you think about it from a brute, hard, cold facts point of view, people are alive, go to war, they come back dead. So the city is a rather complex being, a very complex organic being. It declares the world unknown beyond the walls of the city, enemy territory, where one does not venture unarmed. Is this an optimistic view of the city? Or is this a bleak, pessimistic view of the city? Okay, it's a pretty pessimistic view of the city, that the city takes advantage of its inhabitants, the city abuses its inhabitants, its children, sends them out to war. This is pretty unpatriotic. Right? Reading this, one is not inspired by warm fuzzies about the cause of the nation or the people or the fatherland or the motherland. And yet that's what really the city does. So my challenge or my mission tonight is to try to bear out this argument in favor of Manet's view, a pessimistic view of the city, or are we going to see an optimistic view of the city in looking at Tanakh? And looking at Tanakh's own self-understanding of the origins of the city, what does Tanakh think about the city? And ultimately, when we get to Mitzrayim and Yosef, Mitzrayim as this metropolis, this sort of city writ large, this uber city, city on steroids, what does Chazal and what do the rabbis and what does the Torah think about this city? Okay, so let's open our Tanakhs to Perek Dalid, Pasuk Tesvav. Gracious. Yeah, we're in Sefer Gracious. Everyone has? Okay, so without looking very carefully, what's the first reference to a city in the Torah? Where's the first instance of a city in the Torah? Who? Chanoch. Who is Chanoch? Right, but who is he? And did actually Chanoch build a city?
Kain.
Thank you. So Cain is the father of the first city. Cain is a famous first father of a few things. What is Cain a famous first father of?
Murder.
Not only murder, but a very specific form of murder, right? Fratricide. So Cain is the first father of murder, and the particular version of murder which we call fratricide. Cain is also what? The first father of... What's his occupation? What's Cain's occupation?
Agriculture.
He's a farmer. So Cain is the first farmer. He's the first farmer. He's the father of fratricide. And he happens to be the father of the first city. Is there any relationship between founding the city and being the first perpetrator of fratricide in human history?
Looks bleak.
it's starting off pretty bleak. We're looking pretty bleak. But what's the conceptual connection, if you will, between Cain being the first father of fratricide and the first father of the city?
The city destroys families.
Okay, well, we just saw in Manet, in the reading from the Metamorphosis of the City, that cities destroy families. They sacrifice families to the greater good of the city, to the greater good of the cause. Do you remember another story in history, in ancient history, that connects fratricide with the founding of the city? Are any classicists in the audience, people that love ancient Greek and Roman history? Who founded Rome?
Romulus and Remus.
Romulus kills Remus. Romulus kills his brother Remus to found the city of Rome. Now, in ancient mythology, Romulus and Remus are great types or motifs of brotherly friction and tension. But think about it conceptually. Brothers are what? They're competitive, but they're also what? They're also equals, because they're children of the same parents. So they're both equals and they're competitors. So they have this dual identity as competitors and equals. And that creates the meeting point, the nexus of fratricide. Now, let's take a look inside in the Psukim. That's Cain before we get to the city, right? We know Cain to be the first farmer, and the father of fratricide, the first perpetrator of fratricide. And then, what's your name, sir?
Abraham.
Abraham correctly reminded us that the first founder of the city, of the first city in the Bible, the first city in human history, is Cain. Cain also, by the way, is the father of a seven-generation lineage of creators, of inventors, from metallurgy, music. But here he builds the city. And what does the pasuk say in pasuk Tesvav? Pasuk Tesvayim rather. V'yetze Kain milsnei Hashem. V'yesha be'eretz Nod kidmat Eden. So this is after the murder. He goes to the land of Nod. What does Nod mean in Hebrew? What is Nod? A
wandering,
right? So he's wandering, and then he settles in the land of Nod. Catch the irony there? The land of Nod is the land of wanderers. But he settles down in the land of wanderers because he doesn't want to wander anymore. He wants to be done with wandering. He wants to settle down. Which seems like a pretty innocuous, pretty benign wish. And then what happens? He settles down in the land of Nod, and what does he do? Right? Okay. So he builds the city. Cain doesn't want to rely on wandering anymore. He doesn't trust nature. He doesn't trust God. He doesn't trust his fellow human beings. He wants to trust himself. His flesh and blood, he has a child now, and he builds the city. The city serves as what function? Do you think, just from reading these psukim and knowing what Cain was and who he was, what do you think, David?
It's like an ear miklat.
It's like a refuge, right? It's like an ear miklat. He's afraid of the danger that exists outside of the city, just like we saw in Manet, that outside of the city, everyone is an enemy. Everybody, you wouldn't venture to go outside the city unless you're armed. If you think about the history of political founding, Hobbes said that it's the war of all against all. That in the state of nature, before you have civilization, everybody is killing one another. It's what the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says. Is Israel chayim b'lo. Everyone is swallowing one another. And how do you preserve yourself? How do you protect yourself? You create a city. You create a political order, a political structure. And that's what Cain seems to do.
The vision that comes to mind is that Cain is sick and tired of people creeping up behind him to kill him. He's got to turn around and show them.
Right, the sign that he's protected.
He wants
right.
to be somewhere where he can...
Right. Exactly. So there's a fear of the other. There's a sense of resignation from God's protection. These motives are not exactly noble motives. They're understandable motives. But that's why at the heart of the city, the heart of human civilization, according to one wonderful thinker that I enjoy reading, Leon Cass, he was the chairman of the Council on Bioethics, the President's Council on Bioethics, at the beginning of George W. Bush's presidency. He wrote this wonderful book called The Beginning of Wisdom, Reading Genesis. And he develops this theme over dozens and dozens of pages that at the heart of civilization, there's a stain. At the heart of human creation, the human building of society, political society, there's something that can get very ugly very quickly. And we all feel it when this season it was very easy to feel that politics has a core in it that's ugly. And that's what, at the heart of the city, the very first city, it was Cain's creation. And it's from a sense of fear and loathing and a lack of trust in God, a lack of trust in the human being. It's very Hobbesian, very, very bleak. Okay, two quick questions. Manny.
I'm just wondering, I've glossed over this many times as I've read it, but I'm just wondering in the context of Cain and his wife and no other mentioned people around, what does it mean to build a city?
Well, there were.
Was a building, two tents, let's say.
Well, I mean, there were. I don't want to get into the sort of scientific dimension here, or what the anthropological dimension, but I believe that there were other humanoids. Human.
I'm not denying that there were.
Right. So he was afraid of being, attacked. He was afraid of.
To build a city.
It's exactly the point, Manny. That even when the facts wouldn't bear it out, that it wouldn't even be necessary, Cain feels the need to create this insularity, to create this protection, even though it defies reason. That's on a more philosophical level. On a shot level, I think there were many dangers in nature that he wanted to avoid, that he wanted to protect himself.
A city is a contemporary
as a contained place. Right, that's, you know, what we began with that reading from Manet.
Wild animals.
Right, wild animals, exactly.
I'm not arguing, I'm just trying to clarify.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Ms. Stahl.
It's also built on failure.
In what sense? Okay, the city life is different than the life of the field. It's different than the life of the shepherd. It's different than the life of the farmer. It's a different kind of economic system, for sure. And maybe he's sensing that there was a failure of the earth to respond to him after, you know, the murder, after that fratricide. Now let's look at the Malbim, because the Malbim does a very interesting thing with what we've been saying and actually turns it on its head a bit. It's the first source here, the Malbim 4:16. This is the gracious Dalet Hesbav. Vayhi bone ir, she'achar shehu haya harotzeach harishon. That after the fact that Cain was the first murderer, the first person to commit fratricide, she'haras es hadas hativi, that he destroyed the natural law. He went against nature by murdering another human being, by murdering another creature created in God's image. It's interesting, the Malbim is assuming that there's some natural law, that it's not pure, it's not only covenantal or only revelatory, but that there's human reason that would dictate that murder is immoral. After Cain did this act, Shebezeyu b'nei adam kedage hayam ish esra'eyu chayim yivla. Remember that, right? It reminds you of that Pirkei Avos. It's an allusion to the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, that with this murder, with this first murder, Cain sets in motion a state of reality, a state of nature where all human beings would be like the fish in the sea that would swallow up their neighbors. Ratza l'takein zos b'mashi sheyivne ir. He wanted to remedy this situation. He wanted to countermand this situation. And so he builds a city. Shebal yischabru ha'anashim l'kbos midini. That the people will gather together and create a civil society. They'll create a political society. And they'll establish statutes and protocols and human morality and etiquette. And each brother will help one another. It'll be a fraternal relationship. It'll be a fraternal society. Neged hanikomim imalein, against those that would arise against them. So the Malbim, how would you characterize the Malbim? Is this a pessimistic view? Is this a critique of what Cain does? Or is this a more neutral, even positive assessment? Positive. He's doing tshuva. This is a form of tshuva. Cain is actually engaging in a reparation of the world. Building a city, creating the conditions for civil society, for politics. This is a good thing. This is an advance. This is evolution. A positive development. Progress. Okay. Well, let's move now from the first city, right, the city that Cain builds, to the most paradigmatic city in Sefer Bereishis.
Before we go on, though.
Yes.
He doesn't build it for himself.
Right.
He builds it for his posterity, his son.
Because he is...
He is God.
He's bad.
He's right. And he names it Chano. He names the city because through... It's interesting. I actually didn't include this next little shtickle from the Malbim, but the Malbim goes on to say that he names the city Chanoch. That's his son, but it also means education. Because by the son engaging in the civilization, the son will become educated in the ways of the world, the positive ways in the world, to promote civilization. So that's similar to what Avram is suggesting. That's kind of another indication that this is a positive development. But then things get more complicated. Pardon?
It has ego in it.
Well, ego, there's less ego because he names it for his son, right? He doesn't name it for himself, as opposed to Nimrod, right, who names the city, you know, his own city. And then, of course, Nimrod is the builder of not the first city, but the most paradigmatic city in Sefer Bereishis, which is not Nineveh, before Nineveh. Babel, right? Which Migdal Babel. Babel was the city in which the tower was found. Well, in Migdal Babel, you know, when you read these nine psukim, whatever that, I think there are nine psukim, we really always come back to the question, what did they do wrong? Right? What did they do wrong? And so there are lots of ways to understand this. Just in terms of the placement in Tanakh alone, what's so striking is that the Parsha of Migdal Bavel is the last Parsha in Bereishis before Hashem's calling to Avraham Avinu. It's the end of the beginning. It's the last section in the Torah of God looking at mankind, civilization as a whole, before he now creates this relationship through the calling and the vocation of Avraham Avinu of the Jewish people. So it's a very important text. It's a very important narrative. So I want to look with you at a couple of choice comments from the Nitziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, very erudite, very scholarly, and quite enlightened in many ways as a thinker for a 19th century Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. This was a thoughtful, a sophisticated leader. If you want to read the definitive book about the Nitziv, our very own Tinek's, a pride of Tinek, Rabbi Dr. Gil Pearl, Dr. Pearl's kid, wrote his PhD at Harvard on the Nitziv, and it was published a couple of years ago. I think, Simcha, you have the book?
No?
We got to get that on the list. It's your next door neighbor, so you're holding out for the free copy, probably.
Pearl.
Something, the pillar of the Volozhin or something like that. Okay, so the Nitziv has some fascinating comments about what was the sin of Migdal Bavel, and what then is the sin of the paradigmatic city. Again, Migdal Bavel isn't just a historical or mythological entity, it has theological significance for us if we take Tanakh seriously. So what is it teaching us? So look at that, look at the first here, this is Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, Safa Echas, right? If you look in, you can just look here because it basically covers the Psukim. It was one language, Ze Gorem L'Chet Echa, that one language caused one sin, one big sin. What was that sin? Hayinu Sheyaskinu L'Sheves Kulan B'Kibbutz Echa, that they agreed to dwell in one settlement, in one land. V'Zeu Neged Ratzon Hashem. Wow, this is radical. That the simple desire to dwell in one land, in one plateau, one city, that was against the wishes of God. Because what does Hashem say? What does the Torah say? She'amar shirtzu ba'aretz v'ravu ba, you know, expand, make yourself like little things and, you know, crawl across the entire plain of the world, v'ravu and multiply, haynu lihishalech la'archa l'rachva ki l'shemes yitzra. That you were created, you were designed to dwell, to create settlement all around the world, spread out, you know, across the entire face of the planet. And the project of Babel was precisely the opposite, was to unify mankind in one place, which doesn't seem like such a bad idea, right? The dream of universal humanity, United Nations, this is all, pardon?
Esperanto,
exactly. And the Nitziv has this powerful critique. This is, I argue, a political critique. This is not just a theological critique. This is a political critique. This is a critique against a one-worldism or a radical globalism that does not attend to the individual nation, individual people, individual culture or character. That's what he says.
Fascinating that they chose to go vertical rather than horizontal.
Well, he actually says why. We'll get to that. Okay. Vidvar achadim and unified words, and he asks a question which some of you probably wondered. Lo biyar kasav hadvarim ele beremez. The Torah doesn't tell us what they actually said. They said maybe one thing to get close to Shemayim, but what was the substance of what they actually said? So the Nitziv says that's exactly the point. It didn't matter the content of what they were saying, it was the project to unify their speech. The very project to unify their speech itself was the problem. It wasn't the content of what they said. It was that they were trying to just create one language, Esperanto, one world view. We learn from the fact that the Torah doesn't specify what they actually said. We learn that what they said, the content was secondary. That's not what what made God angry? The very fact of their unification, the so-called unification, that alone was the sin. Look at the next set of comments. The Nisrif of the Sreifa. Here the Nitziv wonders, what are these psukim? If you look, let's turn together to Perek Yud Aleph. Perek Yud Aleph. Okay, so you ever wonder if you think about this narrative here? Vayomru ish el re'eu hava nilvana levenim v'nisrafa l'sreifa. Let's, one friend said the other, let's build these bricks and we'll put it in the fire. But tihilahem halavena la'evin v'achener, and it's going through this whole sort of architect, you know, some kind of, I don't know, morphological or geological, you know, genealogy here, what the bricks and the mortar and the fire and how they did it, and who needs it? We already learned about the first city. This is not the first city. Maybe for the first city, they were explaining how a city was built, the mechanics of it. This wasn't the first city. This was the second city. So what is this all about? So the Nitziv, again, a radical thing. He says, you know what this was all about? What episode, right around this time, had to do with furnaces? The Kivshana Eish. Everybody, we love this medrash. It's from our school days. It's not in the Pesukim, in the Torah. Everyone knows what the Torah says, that he was thrown into the... No, the Torah does not say he was thrown into the Kivshana Eish. The Nitziv says, this is a remez. These words about the Kivshana and the Levanim are all meant to allude to what happened to Avram Avinu. But why? He doesn't just give it a theological sort of, oh, you know, we learned the Medrash and, oh, the Chazal say this, so we want to show, oh, it's in the Pesukim. No, no. He has a political critique. What was the whole point of Avram, of trying to kill Avram? Avram went against the grain of society. Avram was the maverick. He was the iconoclast. Literally, iconoclast means the smasher of idols. Right? He literally smashed the idol of his father, the whole society, Mesopotamian society. He smashed those idols. And for that, they wanted to put him to death. So what the Nitziv is saying is that the correlation between one worldism, by trying to create this artificial Esperanto, everybody speaks one language, and a kind of ideological terrorism. A political correctness, if you will. Where you say something out of line, you can say, I believe in one God, throw him into the pit. That's not pluralism. That's not true diversity. The Nitziv had this great theory of the mind that no two minds are alike. Very insightful, very interesting, metaphysical even. This is the flip side of that. No two minds are alike, and what Babel tried to do was stamp out individuality, stamp out the unique voice of each person, and Avram was the karba. Avram is the alternative to Babel. That's really what the Torah is teaching us, that Avram Avinu is the alternative to Babel, to the culture of Babel and the city. Avram doesn't dwell in the city, remember, right? Lot goes to the city. So, Avram dwells in the tent. He is the radical rival to the life of the city. And this is just, if you continue here in the Nitziv, there's some other beautiful things. I want to move a little further and not get stuck here, but each of these lines, what I said about Avram, if you move down to 11:14, that what was the height of the, this was what David mentioned before, why the city was so tall, why didn't they went from vertical to horizontal? It was to keep tabs on the other cities. Nobody would think that all of humanity could exist in one city. I mean, even that, you know, even with this thematic approach, the Nitziv said no one really could believe that would be possible. So no, they would live in other cities, but Babel would be the highest city, and from there they'd be able to sort of see other cities. That's the idea, that it was so tall so that they could actually serve as like the thought police, very Orwellian, over the other cities. That's what the Zeh Vaday Lo Yala Al Adas at 11:14. Sheyia Ir Achas LaKola Olam Ella Kispurim Sheyu Kola Arim Smuchos V'Tfelos Oso Ir Shabah Migdal. It would serve as a kind of a tower, a watchtower. Okay. So Babel provides a powerful paradigm of where the city can go wrong. The idea of mass culture, the idea of untrammeled ideological uniformity, the presence of political correctness as a method to stamp out individuality. These are all things that it's hard to not see are realities in some way of the modern day city, and we are constantly struggling to be that Abraham that rivals or that offers an alternative to Babel. Now, what's the other great civilization in Sefer Bereishis? Pardon? Well, the other great civilization, Sodom and Gomorrah were minor civilizations. They were offshoots of Babel, offshoots of Canaan. But Mitzrayim, of course, is the great rival, right? And as it says in Vayikra and Achrei Mos, Kamasa Eretz Mitzrayim, Asher Yishavtem Bo Lo Sa'asu, Kamasa Eretz Canaan, Asher Ani Mevi Eschem Lo Sa'asu. They were given these contrasts. Don't do like the ways of Canaan, and don't do like the ways of the Egyptians. Because Egypt, and Cass makes this point very compellingly, if you ask me, Egypt in many ways foreshadows much of what we as modern technologically sophisticated people possess, right? We have a powerful agriculture. We have a powerful science and technology to actually make the most out of natural bounty. We have a bureaucracy and an administration, a public administration. It's not a critique. This is any large civilization, any empire, any society that really develops. But what I want to, and also Yosef and Yehuda become the rivals, right? Because Yehuda, in many ways, is the child, the leader of the children of Leah, and that follows that Abrahamic path, that the nomad, the shepherd, doesn't dwell in the city as Yosef does. So there's a sense of a rivalry there. But there is something that the city offers, and this is how I want to conclude things with all of you tonight. For all of the critique that we've now demonstrated, I hope, in the light or the philosophy of the city, or the dangers, let's say, that the city can create for the spiritual individual, the dangers of Cain's first city, the dangers of Babel as a paradigmatic city, and the dangers of Mitzrayim as a metropolis, there is one thing that I think the city, the modern city, and even the ancient metropolis of Mitzrayim can in fact show. And that I want to do that, I want to look at a couple of quick things. Okay, take a look. There are three times that the Torah in Bereishis and the beginning of Shmos refer to Yirat Elohim. There are three times that the Torah specifically invokes the notion of Yirat Elohim in three separate narratives. Anyone want to take a stab at this? Three times in Bereishis and at the very beginning of Shmos where Yirat Elohim is invoked.
It's Elohim up here, right?
Okay, where is that? Okay, so Avram and Sarah go to Gerar, to the land of Plishtim. Let's take a look quickly there. That's in Parshas Vayera. It's Perek Chaf, Pasuk Yud Aleph. So let's quickly just take a look at the Pasuk and see it inside for a second. Chaf Yud Aleph. Right? So that everyone remembers this is the second episode of Avram and Sarah going to outside of Canaan. First time was to Egypt. Again, no coincidence. First time was down to Egypt. This second time was in the land of the Plishtim. Sarah is a beautiful woman. Avram is afraid that they're going to kill him and take Sarah as a wife. And so he makes up this ruse that they're brother and sister. And he'll be showered with gifts. She'll be safe. Everyone will happily live ever after. God doesn't like this. The Ramban very famously critiques Avraham very severely for his lack of faith in God and his lack of morality in a very serious way to have done that. But when Abimelech, the king of Gerar, presses Avraham and says, why did you do this to me? Why did you pretend that your wife was your sister?
And now God is after me. What does Avram say? What's his excuse? Rak ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh. I'm afraid that there was no yirat Elokim. Okay, that's yirat Elokim number one. And where does this take place, by the way? Remember, in Gur, which is the capital city of the Plishtim. That's episode number one. Okay, fast forward, quickly. Shmos, the beginning of Shmos. There's a mention of Yirat Elokim. Thank you. Shifra and Pua, the Mialadot, the maidservants, those mysterious maidservants that rescued the Jewish boys from Paro. Take a look at your source sheet, the back of page 3. Were these maidservants, were they Jewish or non-Jewish?
No.
Exactly. It's a machlokes. Take a look at Abarbanel, very famously says, Hamialadot, lo hayu livriot. These maidservants were not Jewish. They were Egyptians. And yet they feared God. Okay, that's the second episode. And David, you mentioned earlier this week's Parsha. What happens? There's an encounter between Yosef and who? Asheth Potiphar. Right? Asheth Potiphar, the wife of Potiphar, Yosef's master, Mrs. Potiphar, if you remember your Broadway shows, seduces or tries to seduce Yosef, and Yosef refuses. The Yema'ein, we're going to hear that trump, the Shalshelet. What does Yosef say? Take a look here, Perek Lamed Tes, Pasuk Tes. This is now back in Bereishis, Lamed Tes, Pasuk Tes. Someone got, are you, anyone there yet? Whoever's there yet, just read it for me. Lama Tes Tes. Oh. V'chatasi le'elokim. I will sin to God, Elokim. This is Elokim, Shem Hashem of Elokim, not Yudkei Vavkei. Okay. I want to make it the argument based on Rishonim, based on the Barbanel, based on the Malbim that you have here, that any time the Torah in Bereishis or Shmos mentions Yirat Elohim, it's invoking God in His universal dimension, God in His universal morality, that every human being, irrespective of what tribe you're from, irrespective of what nation you're from, you have a sense of God's covenant. You are a creature of God. Other human beings are creatures created in the image of God. You can't sin against other people. Who are the people that Abraham, Yosef, and the Mialadot? These are all Jews and non-Jews. Abraham is talking to Abimelech, the king of the Plishtim, non-Jew. The Mialadot, non-Jews, according to the Barbanel. Yosef talking to Asheth Potiphar, non-Jew. What the city affords, despite the spiritual temptations and all the dangers that we've documented here tonight, the city affords the possibility of Yirat Shemayim. Because in Yirat Shemayim, you need to be in a universal space. Because if you're in a particular space, if you're in your own tribal space, that's the God of the Jews. That's Hashem Hashem of Yudke Vavke. But when you live amongst non-Jews, when you live in a pluralistic society, when you live where different tribes need to get together, the only way to survive morally is to have Yirat Elokim. The Malbim here, the last source that I want to quickly look at you with you, says something amazing. And you can read it to yourself. The Malbim at Pasuk, at Perek Chav, Pasuk Yudal. This is by Abraham telling Abimelech that there's no rak in Yirat Elokim. Shodir lo shagam im nira ish o am shehu filosof gadol, that if you see a great philosopher, v'chakak lo nimusi nisharim, and that they've established very wise and just protocols and ethics, v'hirgil as atzmo b'midos togos, it's a little typo, v'hirgil asmo b'midos togos, they behave well, Abi atzas sichlo, according to their own reason. Vuhu osa mishpat usaka, sounds great. Hako abi atzas sichlo. Vichol ze lo nuchal liftoach ala ish ahu o ha'am ahu. You cannot guarantee that ethics and morality will survive. If human morality is purely human, without Yirat Elohim, there's no guarantee that morality will survive. We can look at human history, look at the 20th century alone, to see what the greatest, most enlightened thinkers, the greatest philosophers, the nation that spawned Kant and Mozart, what happened, how quickly they became barbarians. Because Ein Yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh. But the city actually tests the possibility of Yirat Elohim. Because the city, with all its multifariousness, with all its pluralism, with all its diversity, then you can say, I'm bound, all of us, we're all created in God's image. But Yirat Elohim. If you're in your own city, that's not Yirat Elohim. That's Shem Hashem, you gave up it. That's just the God of the Jews. But if you're in a city, you can test the composition of Yirat Elohim. Is there Yirat Elohim here, or is there not Yirat Elohim? Ultimately, it has to be Yirat Elohim, not the human ethics, not the merely mortal morality that the Malbim warns us against. You can have Yirat Elohim. You can even have, and that's theology, you can have some common theology that we all share, that we're all created in God's image. We don't have to agree about doctrine. We don't have to agree about theology, the pratim, the details of ritual, or even theology in the sense of the nature of God. We can disagree. We can have human civil discourse and debate about that. But we, at the end of the day, we need a morality that is bound by God's law, that we are created in God's image. That's Yirat Elohim. And that's Yosef's temptation in Mitzrayim. When there's a metropolis, when there are all the temptations of the city, to still invoke God, the Mustiyak Nosha of it. He was able to see the image of his father Yaakov, and that's what protected him from the temptation of the city. Have a wonderful Shabbos, everybody.
Thank you.